Why do we exist? Were we created with a purpose? Or are we just here by chance? What are we to believe about life, faith, and worldview? Welcome to The Universe Next Door, focusing on answers to the questions we all consider. The Universe Next Door is supported by the C.S. Lewis Society, Trinity College of Florida, and supported by gifts from listeners just like you. Discover more resources and continue the conversation at apologetics.org. And now, your host, the research professor of Bible and theology at Trinity College of Florida, author and speaker, Dr. Tom Woodward.
Welcome to The Universe Next Door. I hope you're doing well today, and if you live on the same side of the universe that we do, I hope you're preparing for the half a dozen or so storms that seem to be brewing out in the Atlantic Ocean. Dr. Woodward, have you been keeping up with that at all?
Oh, yes. We have our news channels and our weather channels pumping out that information day and night. Boy, we have some of our children are up in Columbus, Georgia, and they've been watching the drift of these storms through their area. It's crazy.
Oh, yeah, it is. That's when you know it's September in Florida. You turn on the news and there's hurricanes left and right coming up.
I'm just glad that we were not living in Pensacola the past week or two.
Oh, I know. Yeah, that storm that came over, I didn't even know it turned into a hurricane. That was a few days of rain.
Amazing. So, I'm ready to jump into the excitement of science and like the science of Jesus. I've got a new phrase to talk about, and by the way, pass the saltation when you're at it. That's what we're gonna talk about, like, you know, for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Sometimes you pass the salt, and today we're gonna pass the saltation.
Uh-huh. Yes, let's do it.
So, our listeners may be wondering, what in the world is Dr. Woodward regaling us with today? So, can I cut to the chase? Are we good to go, Nick?
Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
Okay, well, and by the way, just a warm greeting to all those who listen, whether podcast, pulling us up on our platform there at apologetics.org, or accessing it through your local radio station from coast to coast. You know, our various radio stations are so wonderful. We thank you for that channel of the communication to our loyal listeners. But we wanted to just say that we are so excited that we have, by the grace of God, become the recipients of the entire set of audio video events that were presented to an audience of nearly 7,000 at the arena in Bangor, Maine. You maybe remember us talking about this over the last probably 6 or 8 weeks, hasn't it, Nick? We've been talking about this.
Yeah, I believe so.
Mm-hmm. And so we have been able to, every 2 weeks, and we're going to continue doing this all through the fall and even into this winter and spring. Every 2 weeks, you can look for us to upload another major talk or Q&A or debate or some kind of interview that we've been able to produce over the last few years. We've been able to access and now put in professional format the YouTube version. They're all at YouTube as well, but they're readily accessible right there on our homepage at apologetics.org. And it's the Why Jesus. That's the key words. Why Jesus? ? And that was the series of five plenary lectures, five talks. I was able to give the one called Why Jesus Not Science. That's been up on our homepage about 3 or 4 months. But we've added the Robbie Zacharias talk from Why Jesus and the Q&A. That was a separate 38 minutes of rich questions from the audience. And then we added the panel discussion just this past week, and we're going to add talks by two other outstanding lecturers on evidence for Christ and why Jesus. And then we're going to go right on in to Intersect, an amazing event that took place here in Florida. And that involved Daryl Bach and Greg Kokel and myself. We were just so excited to be able to just, again, two a month, just space out this feast of great apologetics material flowing to you through the web platform of apologetics.org. And so that's part of the rich feast. And when you're enjoying the feast, sometimes you say, pass the salt, right? My wife and I sometimes will pull up some TV trays, two TV trays, and sit on our little recliners in front of We have now a good size screen TV, and we can watch our favorite show, and or maybe watch the evening news if we want. And she has a little salt shaker by her table next to her seat. And I will sometimes say, pass the salt. But I think I will shock her tonight, because I'm going to say, pass the saltation. And she, I guarantee, she'll look at me and say, what? But she will probably remember the word saltation, because I've used it in my talks. And she's actually given talks to kids on fossils. And so, Nick, you've probably heard that word before. Stephen Jay Gould would talk about it. And if you're from a Hispanic background, those of you who have had the blessing of growing up or maybe even just studying Spanish, saltar, the Spanish verb, or salto, I think, is even used maybe in Italian or other Romance languages. That root, saltus, it means to jump. And so in the ideas of,
oh, wow,
of Darwinian theory, everything has to be gradual, like a ramp. Like a gradual ramp going up to from one level to another, but no jumps are allowed. And in other words, this has been an issue when Darwin himself wrote the book Origin of Species. His closest friends and even Huxley, T.H. Huxley, said to him in a letter, he said, "I think you've loaded yourself with a difficulty, Charles, because you have not opened yourself up to the possibility of sudden changes." And then Charles scoffed at that idea in his reply to Huxley. He said, "I might as well bring God into the equation. If I added jumps, mysterious jumps, everything must be slow and gradual, you know, a little teeny bit here, a little teeny bit there." And so if you want to use the word genius, the genius of Darwinian theory, to the extent that it is attractive, to the extent that it sounds plausible, is that it allows nature to do what, at least in our imagination, nature seems at first blush, at first glance, that it could do. And that is accomplishing gradual, step by tiny, minuscule step changes over time. And it was this classic view of Darwinian theory that was attacked in 1985 in the book that launched the intelligent design movement, written by an agnostic, no less, and that was Michael Denton. Of course, the book Evolution, A Theory in Crisis. Let me repeat that name one more time. Evolution, A Theory in Crisis, the book that rocked the world. And it received notification, and I might say negative response, in some of the leading scientific journals in the world. And I actually have a bulging file with 100 pages of letters and reviews that Michael Denton mailed to me from Australia when he was doing genetics research at a big hospital there in southern Australia. And I was actually working with university students in the Dominican Republic at that time. We hadn't even taken up our current post teaching at Trinity College. That was the year before. And when I received that packet and opened it up with great interest, and I read page after page at the shock expressed by these scientists and professors around the world saying, this gentleman seems to say that the gradual theory of Darwinian evolution may work at the minor level, but it is absolutely empty of any empirical support at the macro level. How can that be so? How could he say such an awful, scandalous, you know, just horrific, damaging thing about our wonderful theory? But as Denton laid out the case, he showed that when you look at the evidence, everything seems to be a separate kind appearing suddenly with no transitions. And not only no transitions in the fossil record, but you can't even imagine these complex structures like the wing or even the individual avian feather of a bird, or, and that's what I'd like to emphasize today, the lung of a bird appearing in the blink of an eye. It suddenly appears, and you can't even imagine a slow, gradual transition. Therefore, it has to have according to this new theory of evolution that was being brought in at that point in the 1980s, a saltation. So the idea of a saltation, and that's the main focus of my thought today, my research that I'd like to share. The saltation idea was brought in as a rescue for the Darwinian theory as it was beginning to sink into the North Atlantic like the Titanic. What do I mean by sinking? What do I mean by it's a Titanic that has been hit by the iceberg? Well, Darwinian theory seemed to be supported just because no one was really testing it rigorously. There were all kinds of rumors of problems here and difficulties there. But no one was really at the time of the centennial in 1959. I wasn't paying much attention. I was only 9 years old at the time. But everybody was celebrating this great theory that had triumphed. But shortly after that, even literally 1 or 2 years after that, G.A. Kirkcutt in England was publishing from his post as professor at Southampton University an amazing book called Implications of Evolution, where he outlined 7 major assumptions grounding, like the foundational assumptions of evolution, none of which were even open to proof of any support. And none had even come close to having any direct supporting proof. And yet all of these assumptions you had to accept as true if the theory was true. And so that was the first major question that was hurled at the theory. And then one by one, and I detail these in my books, Doubts About Darwin, the opening 2 chapters, and then Darwin Strikes Back, my sequel, brings these out. But as you get into the biggest bombshell, the most high potency, high octane attack on the macro theory of Darwin, the idea that all life forms are descended from a single common ancestor, and that all of this diversification, all this development of complexity, all of this change happened through nature alone. That attack, really, when it occurred in 1985, at the hands of an agnostic, Michael Denton, in his book Evolution and Theory in Christ, was really using this focal point of saltations. He was pointing out that if evolution couldn't happen through any kind of gradual change, then what he was saying is that everywhere you see, everywhere you look in evolution, looking for proof, you don't see any gradualism. All you see is sudden jumps, sudden leaps, and it's not happening, obviously, through any selection, natural selection of random mutations. And that is the core of his attack. And his main example, he actually has 54 examples in just one chapter. And this chapter, I think it's chapter 10 or 11 in his book, called Bridging the Gaps. I'm actually in my office Newport Richey. I have several copies of Denton in my other office in Trinity, Florida. But if I were to pull out that chapter, I would probably see more wows written in the margins of that chapter of my Denton book than any other chapter. Because in that one chapter, like I said, he details not one, not two, not a dozen, not even 4 dozen. He goes to 54 examples. Wow. Where macroevolutionary theory has completely flopped and failed to give any plausible step-by-step development of major structures in the world of living plants and animals and microbes. And the one that really grabbed my attention is the unique structure of bird lungs. And that's where I've done some research recently, because the evolutionists think that they've had a little bit of a breakthrough, and I think their breakthrough is non-existent. Let me explain the problem. Bird lungs are unique. I mean, human lungs, like all mammalian lungs, like all reptilian lungs, like all amphibian lungs of salamanders and frogs or whatever, all lungs of everything that walks or lives or crawls on the earth and not in the seas, of course, you know, fish have gills, they don't have lungs. But if you're on the land and if you're breathing air, you have lungs, except birds. The 8,000 or so species of birds have a unique, completely different structure of lung. Now, most people who studied biology in the area of birds may have picked up on this. If you haven't, this may be new to you. But welcome to the mystery, to the fascinating, almost shocking fact of birds and the structure of breathing that they use, the actual physiology, the structure, or morphe, we call it in Greek terminology, the structure or morphology of their lung. And that is, the air comes in one tube, it breaks out into parallel branches. Think of a tube that suddenly branches out into 3 and then 10 and then 100 parallel and then 1,000 parallel branches. And that's where the oxygen exchange takes place. Those branches then keep going in one direction, and they coalesce, they start joining up, and then they come together finally in an exit branch into one singular tube, and it exits out through the bird's mouth. Now, the air was coming in through the bird's mouth, and then that final end tube comes out through the other side of the bird's mouth, so you have a circulatory system that never ends. In other words, the air doesn't go into some pockets or sacs like it does in a human or mammalian or reptilian lung and then reverse direction. It's not like a bellows. Some of us from up north who have used a bellows to keep fires going at night in the fireplace, we know what a bellows is, where you open and close, and the air reverses through the little spout and the bellows. Well, the bellows lung, or the inverted tree lung that we all enjoy, that we all have if we're blessed at birth, of course, with two lungs. So the birds don't have that kind of lung. The birds have a unique set of valves and structures built into their chest and to their upper part of their body that keeps the air flowing in one direction. That, to me, is a marvel of engineering design. And every single one, without exception, every bird has the same flow-through bird lung. Now, how, asks Michael Denton, how, step by tiny step, could you take a structure that, if birds came from reptiles, as we're told in the Jurassic Park movie and by most evolutionists today, if birds derived from some branch of the dinosaurs, which had, you know, the same kind of lungs that we have, how were those bellows or dead-end lungs gradually, step by tiny step, transformed into flow-through lungs? You can't even imagine it, and no one in the world of biology has come up with a plausible step by tiny step micromutation-driven story or scenario by which that those changes could take place. Now, I will add that there is a proposed discovery that was just brought out recently, and that discovery says that there is a certain kind of a dinosaur. It's called, and I'm reading this off my notes, a theropod dinosaur called a Majungatholus atopus. Welcome to the world of Majungatholus atopus. I'll bet you haven't heard of that name.
No, I don't think I have.
No, this is new to me. Well, in an article published within the last dozen or so years, there was a couple of articles about this, and the Majungatholus atopus, a theropod dinosaur, had what was, according to some evolutionary analysts, a structure of its spinal vertebral, that is, bones, that had penetrating air sacs that looked suspiciously bird-like. In other words, they don't have any idea, they don't have any direct evidence of what that dinosaur's lung looked like. But they said just looking at his ribs and looking at the kind of interwoven air channels in his vertebral bones, he looked somewhat more like a bird than a regular dinosaur. And so they said, aha, I'll bet this dinosaur maybe sprouted something like feathers, but, and therefore was probably a forerunner of birds, but was a flow-through lung dinosaur. And therefore, flow-through lungs are not just in birds. They were in some of these dinosaurs that were in the process of evolving into birds. The only problem with that theory, number one, is there's no direct evidence of that assertion. We have very minimal you might say it's suggestive evidence, and I would say, just looking at it from raw scientific, objective standpoint, I would say, well, that's interesting. That's an interesting theory. Can you find any evidence of a flow through lung if you find sometimes soft tissue preserved? If there were, then I would be more convinced, obviously. Now, when the creation scientists looked at this report, when it was published, a number of them pointed out the obvious, that the researchers who pointed out that this suspicious-looking set of vertebra with holes in it looked, not only was it a theropod dinosaur, but it looked a little bit like a bird set of vertebra because it had these aeration channels. They said, well, does that really show how a bird lung, radically different design lung structure, could have developed step by tiny step? No, the article never even attempted. It didn't even move one inch down that mile-long plausible proposal, that is, to propose a plausible pathway of how it could have step by step, in a way that really makes sense. And so, and some people say, well, just because we can't show how it couldn't have happened doesn't mean it didn't happen. Well, I mean, we can obviously propose anything we want. I can say that I can jump to the moon, and and I can say that I just can't show you how I did it, that it's a possible theory. Well, I would like to see the plausibility aspects of it. Show me the ability. Well, I mean, I can jump maybe 2 feet. 3 feet might be a little bit of a stretch. 5 feet, forget about it. 220,000 miles to the moon. I mean, who is really seriously even, awake and talking like this? So I guess my quick response is that sulcations are the ultimate indicator of a theory that is in its death throes. Because if a gradualistic theory is struggling to explain phenomenon that really rely on nature only, nature-driven changes only, then the saltation, that is the sudden appearance of new structures, of new complex organs and organisms, are really the kind of the embarrassment. They're like the manifest struggle or death rattle of that theory. Now, let me just make, since we only have a minute left, let me just make this quick point. The follow-up to Michael Denton's book, Evolution of Theory Crisis, was a new release, an entirely, I'd say, two-thirds new book called Evolution, Still a Theory in Crisis, that just came out about 3.5 years ago. A very fine book, and in some ways even more powerful than the original. But it had this weakness, that Michael Denton, still not a theistic, Christian-type believer, which is very fascinating. I look forward to maybe having him on our program. We can have a nice discussion of these issues. But in the 30 seconds that remain, let me just say this, that Michael Denton himself has snuggled, since he does not have a creation concept, he has snuggled his own mysterious saltations. And he says that nature has these saltations built into it. And I think that although his critique of Darwin is fantastic, perhaps the best ever written, his own saltation theory lacks credibility. So I think to my wife, yes, pass the salt, but I don't think I'll ask her to pass the saltation. Back to you, Nick.
Oh, and it absolutely is an issue that what we're proposing here is in complete opposition to Darwinism, that things slowly changed over time, while proposing, on the other hand, that they jumped from thing to thing is completely contradictory. But thank you for listening. We appreciate you. If you have any questions or comments, please send an email to information@apologetics.org, and we'll see you back here next week on The Universe Next Door.
You've been listening to The Universe Next Door with Dr. Tom Woodward, sponsored by the C.S. Lewis Society and Trinity College of Florida, and supported through the gifts of listeners just like you. To gather resources, continue the conversation, and support The Universe Next Door with your financial gifts, go to apologetics.org. That's apologetics.org. And join us again next time as we continue to seek the truth about life, faith, and worldview in The Universe Next Door.